Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Everybody, and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdell. I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Christian Esquivin, who is a writer who has considered the fashion designer, the costumer of filmmaking in his new book, Designing Hollywood. It's a fascinating insight into an often overlooked part of the film industry, and he focuses particularly on the studio period when legendary designers such as Edith Head and Adrian created the stars and the iconic looks that we know today. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like, subscribe. If you leave a review, that's great. And if you can think of any other way of sharing the content, we would be very happy indeed. One of the things I love about doing Writers on Film is the fact that because we're not tied to any release calendar, we can basically go from subject to subject, topic to topic, and that means that we can have a really broad look at cinema in all its workings. So today it's a real delight to look at costume design. I would say I haven't really considered much prior to reading Christian's book. So this is a really informative episode and one that was a lot of fun to produce. I hope you enjoy it. I'd like to start by asking how you first became interested in costumes per se. Is that part of the filmmaking process?
Well, it was kind of a bit of a slow process for me. My great aunt had worked for the studios starting in back in 1925 with MGM. She worked in wardrobe and then the Fox Studios and then finally RKO as the what was known as the head cutter and fitter. And as such, she worked very closely with the costume designers and worked also closely with the head or the leading movie stars of that era, the leading ladies, Ginger Rogers, Katharine Hepburn, Maureen O'Hara, Lucille Ball, and many others. So I was very young at the time, and And she, by the time I was young, she had retired, but she used to costume me for French occasions, the Bastille Day and various holidays.
Because your family's French?
Yes, I was born in
Right, I
France,
see.
but I came to the States when I was four. But anyway, that's kind of an aside. But when she, after she passed, I inherited many of her photographs and costume design sketches. And although she had told me some stories, it was mainly in researching who those people were and what movies they came from that I became interested in the whole background story. And one thing led to another, and I started collecting costume design sketches on my own, and then got interested through another acquaintance about Adrian. He was one of the best of the costume designers, and I wrote a book about him, and then this other book, which was broadly about all of the others that I became interested in also.
The sense I got from reading your book that it's almost like an act of justice as well, that the especially at the very beginning of the industry, you make a point repeatedly that they're not credited. You know, there comes a point where you sort of get in the chapter where you're saying, finally they get credited. This is the first one to start getting screen credit, or this is the first time this particular designer gets a screen credit.
Yes, and that was my aim, not only to record some of the designers that got little credit and are not well known, but especially the wardrobe people. In the first several decades, they got no credit on screen, and even when they're photographed with a costume designer and a famous movie star, they usually on the back of the photograph have a snipe, it's called, or it's actually printed on the back of the photograph. Here's a costume designer X, and here's a famous movie star Y, and they'll show somebody from the wardrobe department, and it gives no name for them. So even the photograph with their image, they don't even say who it is most of the time, let alone a credit on the screen. Nowadays, of course, they do. They even name caterers and chauffeurs and personal assistants and everybody, absolutely everybody has anything to do in movie making now. But for the first several decades, they did not. So I wanted to try to ferret out some of these wardrobe assistants, wardrobe ladies, they were all often called. Now they're usually called costumers or costume assistants, let alone the more important people, like the cutters and fitters, and also the talented, skilled labor beaters, embroiderers, and a whole host of people in the background that produced all of these costumes that we see and appreciate on film.
There's a real sense as well. I love that you include all that information because and you tell all those stories because often a studio will vaunt the fact that it used, you know, 5,000, you know, hundreds of handmade costumes, but that handmadeness, you know, those hands belonged to people and they were doing that as a, you know, a highly skilled professionals that contributed to those films.
Yes, they even used lace makers that they were hired to make from scratch, a very detailed lace shawl or lace mantle or whatever it took. And same with embroidery, which in couture is a very expensive and labor-intensive process. The studios, the bigger ones, hired the people to do that, and most of what I cover here, in fact, almost all of it, is what was done as the so-called studio system, and that's where the studio itself hired everybody that was necessary to produce a movie. They had the writers, they had the carpenters, they had the teachers for the child actors, they had people that would take an actress, say, that came from the Deep South with a heavy accent, and they would give them a proper, English modified accent so that they could be understood. And in wardrobe, they had the beaters, they had the dyers, they had the shoemaker, and the iron workers, the coops, same for making weapons of all sorts. They had everybody, barbers, everybody it took to produce a movie from A to Z. And that system fell apart finally because financially. But that's the period that I wrote about, which ended usually by 1970.
When you, I mean, you begin chronologically and you separate the chapters into different studios. So you're sort of doing each history of the
That's
studio, and some of the designers are hopping, like your great aunt, are going from one studio to the other, and their career might
Yes.
have substantial. I thought it was also interesting that some of the great fashion names of the day have sort of a checkered history with the movie studios. One of the early ones that you mentioned is Coco Chanel, who has sort of a fleeting moment in Hollywood and is not, and that relationship doesn't go particularly well.
Yes, of course she had a big name from early on, from even before the 1920s. Another one was Hergé, but let's look at Coco Chanel, for example. So the studios recognized, the moguls recognized early on that they could sell the movies, they could promote the movies through fashion. The larger part of a movie audience were women. And women were attracted to going to movies by the clothes that the actresses wore. So they promoted those fashions in movie magazines, in newspapers, and they recognized that they needed to get the most talented costume designers they could. And if they could get a costume designer or a fashion designer with a big name, they could get a lot of publicity ahead of time to get that women audience going to the movies. So Coco Chanel was a big name. So they thought they would try her in combination with Gloria Swanson. The problem was that backfired a little bit because she didn't want to establish herself by moving to Hollywood. Gloria Swanson didn't want to decamp to France for a long period of time, although she had gone there earlier to marry a titled husband. That lasted for a little bit. So anyway, Coco Chanel got Gloria Swanson's measurements, and she designed several costumes. And in the meantime, she gained a little weight, so that became a problem. And Chanel's approach to designing the costumes for Gloria Swanson was as if she was just another customer in her couture establishment, rather than designing the costumes to fit the needs of any particular scene. So they didn't make quite the splash that they thought they would get out of a name like Chanel. So that situation didn't. In some of Chanel's later films, by the 50s and 60s, she kind of did a better job of that, but in the 30s it didn't work out so well.
And there were so at the beginning of the studio system and all the way through the period you're talking about, the costumes really define to a great degree the look of certain stars. You know, you have a certain a certain, I mean, you know, Marilyn Monroe's white dress, a James Dean's red jacket. And these have become sort of iconic, but even before then, it was really important that each individual star have sort of a specific feel to them. Were there great partnerships between designers and stars, or was that very much the studio running that show?
There were those great partnerships, and that worked because there was the studio system, which, although costume designers did eventually go from one studio to the other, because they had the studio system and because they had contracts, and they were long-term contracts, usually they were 7 years, especially in the earlier years. So somebody like Adrian could have a long-term relationship with Greta Garbo and Joan Crawford and others, and Ori Kelly could have a long-term relationship with Bette Davis, and also with others. They could and Travis Banton with Claudette Colbert and others. They could really create their image in the earliest years of their career, and certainly with Marilyn Monroe, that was with Trivia. So, and it was usually an image of glamour, because that was very important, especially in the 1930s, early 1930s. That was a period of the Great Depression, and although the women attending couldn't buy those looks for themselves, they fantasized about the whole look of not only the costumes but the decor of the settings, but vis-a-vis the image of the movie stars, they were created by the costume designers. So they tended to be repeated in movie after movie after movie, and that's what the audience wanted. They didn't want them appearing glamorous in one movie and then appearing looking like a bum in the next movie, or looking completely down and out. Now, there was often the theme of the movie star that started out humbly and then made good and appeared really glamorous at the end. Now, that was allowable, and especially in a lot of the Joan Crawford movies. But by and large, it was you dress well, and you end up making out well. So it was the clothes that made the star, and it was the costume designer that made the clothes that helped you out in the long run. And those images were kind of demanded by the audience in the long run. They didn't like seeing their movie stars look much different than the glamorous images they had of them. And that was true outside of the theater, at home, on the street, etc. It was completely different than what we have today.
Was it was there ever right? Oh, there must have been rivalry between some of these costume designers, but also some of these actresses who would want to poach a designer off another actress, perhaps, or you can't dress her if you're dressing me.
Yeah, there were certainly jealousies and rivalries between designers. Sometimes there were some friendships, but there were a lot of rivalries and jealousies, and just like many fields, they'd see what somebody was doing that, oh, why didn't I think of that? Or let me try to copy that a little bit. And on a certain extent, it was flattery, but how much can you do before somebody says, "Hey, you're cheating here by copying my look." And that happened with Adrian in the Letty Linton movie, and what came to be known as the Letty Linton dress. It not only influenced every other costume designers, but many of the fashion designers in Europe who copied that look.
Right, it's sort of victim of their own success.
Yeah, and Helen Rose with her dress for Elizabeth Taylor, that Cat on the Hot Tin Roof, that cocktail dress came to be known as the cat dress. All the clothes manufacturers knocked it off, and she was so mad about that, she said, "Well, I'm just going to open up my own fashion line," and that's what she ended up doing.
And you mentioned earlier that, of course, there was the Great Depression. And I think it's an interesting point that you make in the book that, of course, as well as this glamour, as well as this sort of Purple Rose of Cairo style glamour movie, you also had Grapes of Wrath. And those kinds of films, Sullivan's Travels, those kinds of films also required costume designers. They didn't just go out and get the clothes. They designed the costumes for that kind of film, just like you would in any theatrical film.
Yes. Yeah, when they do turn either purposefully because it's the part they have to play to look down and out, or you know, Grapes of Wrath or Sullivan's Travels, either it's where they start or it's the transition they're going to. Yes, they have to design those, and in certain films. Costumes have to be aged also because they can't appear to be brand new. So there's a whole art to aging costumes so that they appear like, you know, certainly certain war movies, battlefield type military costumes have to be aged, etc. But you know, there's an art to that as well. And every costume essentially has to fit the character and the scene. So that's where a designer starts. They have to read the screenplay. They have to break each scene down. So where does it take place? When does it take place? What are the surroundings? What is the character doing? So the costume has to further the plot and further develop the character and the costume design. So a lot of that in the 30s was to enhance the look and the fashion interest of bringing women in. But that was for a certain period. By the 1940s, because of the war in Europe, films and their costumes got a lot more realistic, you know, with all of the horror going on overseas. Glamour took a back seat pretty much, and certainly with film noir, it became a different look.
I remember, obviously, Casablanca has this wonderful, wonderfully dressed Ingrid Bergman in the film, and it has some wonderful costumes in the film because it's set in this exotic cafe. But I always remember as well the scene where she goes to buy some cloth, because yeah, in the marketplace, and even though she looks pristine, there's a sense that she must only have two or three dresses in her suitcase as she's rushed from occupied France.
Yeah, that was a kind of an early wartime movie, early for America, not so much in Europe, but early for America. So Ori Kelly designed that, and she had, you know, she had a nice wardrobe, considering the reality of the time. But it was she looked great, and he did a good job of designing her clothes to make her look great. And that's certainly a great movie.
When we talk about clothes, often we're talking about 80-90% of the time we're talking about the women, and we're talking about the, you know, as we've already mentioned, Bette Davis and Joan Crawford and Ingrid Bergman, and we could go on and on. But also in that film, you've sort of got Humphrey Bogart in his white tux and his, how much are the men sort of, are they just more it's off the hook, or are they getting as carefully manufactured as the women?
Well, actually, it was quite a bit different for the men. Usually, unless it's a period movie, a historical setting, they tended to wear their own clothes.
Right. So my guess is pretty good then.
So they would have their own tailors that they liked in Hollywood, and they would wear their own tuxes or their own they'd have their own suits made. That was true for the best dressed Fred Astaire, Cary Grant, and many of the others. But as soon as they got into a setting where it was a period setting, then they would have their costumes made at the studio. And there were several designers that designed for men exclusively. Sometimes there'd be a designer that could dress for either men or women. There were a few of those, but there were specialists in design.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
For men. So obviously all the biblical movies, the military movies, the ones from the 1880s, the turn of the century, and so forth. And then they'd have to they'd go through the same process the women did. They'd have to go through fittings, as they called them, where the costume would be designed. It'd be made in the wardrobe department. The men would have to go and be fitted once and then twice with the designer and the head cutter and fitter to make sure that it was perfectly fit. And in the case of women, they'd even have dress forms that were made to their exact measurements. With men, women's costumes mostly were made by seamstresses. Men's costumes were mostly made by tailors, but they'd have both in the wardrobe department.
And thinking about that period then of the sort of pre-war period when the costumers designers were much more where you didn't have the scarcity that came with the war and you didn't have that realism, they were could be a bit more extravagant. Who were the names who for you personally, what were the films that you think, oh, that's my favorite to go back and revisit as a on from the point of view of the costume design?
Well, there are so many. I really like My Man Godfrey. That was one that that Travis Banton designed. Edith Head also did some of the costumes for that. At MGM, they did so many, and Paramount also. Adrian's films at MGM. The Greta Garbo movies, the ones in exotic settings like Mata Hari with Greta Garbo. I mean, they were totally unrealistic as far as costumes, but you just look at the how fabulous that's this one costume for Greta Garbo, and it's totally symbolic. It's made totally out of bugle beads, which are, they're just straight. They're not really shaped like the curved part of a bugle, but the straight or not rectangular because they're tubular shaped, but they're beads and they have to be sewn one after the other. and they were sewn even to make her pants. And above that, she has a split top and skirt, completely embroidered with crystals and beads. So it looks like armor in the, but the back is, her back is totally exposed and it's backless. So here she's got this armor front, and as a spy, she's totally unprotected at the back. So it's so symbolic of her character as a spy who ends up, of course, being executed. And it, you know, it's a black and white movie, but that whole piece was made out of gold, primarily bugle beads. And that's just one. There were so many fabulous movies coming out of MGM designed by Adrian, and at Paramount it was Travis Benton, and he did so many great costumes for Carol Lombard, again using bugle beads, which all had to be hand sewn together. But the advantage to those costumes were they really reflected the light. And they were so heavy, you know, they usually weighed about 35 pounds, but they were so heavy that they completely contoured the body. In the later 30s, you know, after 35, there was censorship. So they couldn't really expose the body, but these costumes really brought out the shape of a woman's figure. Whereas, you know, before 1934, they could expose a lot of it, which they did in the movies of the 20s, especially the silent movies. And that was completely different. You know, a lot of the biblical movies did that. And I had mentioned an anecdote for one of the actresses, Betty Blythe. She did a movie called The Queen of Sheba that came out in 1921. And she quipped that she could wear all of her costumes in the movie at once, and she still wouldn't be able to keep warm.
And there were about 20 costumes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a very interesting point you make as well about black and white, because, of course, you have black and white, then you have the shift to color. I mean, were the black and white costumes, were there certain colors that they just couldn't use because it didn't show up well under the lights in black and white films? Were there certain colors or certain matches that they would, or did they just dress normally dress as you would for the naked eye, so to speak, and it would be okay?
No, they'd usually have to test a little bit, see what worked and what didn't, because, you know, sometimes medium colored past. And by the way, they did design in color. The actors had to feel realistic in the costumes they wore. So they didn't want to wear, you know, gray costumes or, you know, uncolored costumes. They wanted, you know, the real thing. So there's a still in my book of Katharine Hepburn as Mary of Scotland, and it's almost all in red and or burgundy, for example, and it comes out, you know, in various shades of gray or dark gray, but it's primarily a red and rich burgundy color. So they would often test, because some, depending on the particular color, it could come out really light or it could come out really dark. That famous movie Jezebel with Betty Davis, where she's supposedly makes a scandal when she shows up at a ball wearing a red gown, a red dress. So it has to appear like it's a red dress. So how do you do that in a black and white movie? So they had to play around with that, and the fabric that they chose was a bronze colored fabric. And, you know, with a little bit of imagination, you can, you know, it does appear very different from all the other dresses at that ball. And what was another famous example? But anyway, they did have to both test. And on the other hand, I've got one of my great aunts' kind of ledger books where she includes many fabric samples from black and white films from RKO, and they're all beautiful colors, beautiful pastel colors, rich burgundy colors, blues, grains. None of them are grays or blacks, or they couldn't use whites because they just reverberated the lights too much. So they'd have to use off or white.
But when color turned up, when you started getting films in color, that must have led to check to oh well, maybe not if they're costuming in color anyway, it doesn't really change anything once they start filming in color, right?
Well, the problem with color, the first color, not the first, but the early color came with Technicolor, and Technicolor was a corporation, and Technicolor used their own cameras. And Technicolor, if you use Technicolor, you use their cameras, and if you used them, they had their own consultant that went on the set and told them what colors they could use and what colors they couldn't use in costumes and set design, which was a real nuisance. David O. Selznick complained vociferously about that in Gone with the Wind, for example. And so did Walter Plunkett, the costume designer. He said, you may as well have them design the costumes because they kept saying, well, you can't use this color and you can't use that color. And so yeah, it became an issue as to what color you could use and couldn't use because you had to go through Technicolor, get their approval. And white was definitely a no-go because they had to use so much high intensity lighting that it just glowed, reverberated if it was pure white.
Right. Yeah. It's this is an impossible question, I know, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because I think impossible questions get some interesting answers. Who do you think is the best dressed star of that period for you? Who's the one that you think, oh, they're always they match their clothes. The clothes are always well designed for them.
Well, there would be several, but I think one of my favorites is Loretta Young. Yeah, she was always she and she moved around to several different studios, but she always managed to be very well dressed, whatever studio she went to, and whatever film. And she had an excellent figure, Earl Lueck. Who dressed her early, very early, at First National, which was bought out early by Warner Brothers, said she had a better figure than Jean Harlow,
Wow.
who was known to have a great figure.
And as we go on into sort of we come up we're heading towards the end of the studio era, you start getting people who are dressing more realistically to some degree. You mention in the book as well that I mentioned it earlier, James Dean's famous sort of red jacket from Rebel Without a Cause, that I think there's a story that he, oh, I got it from a shop, and the designer says, no, I bought this nylon especially and I made it. But there is this sense that people are wearing more. I don't know, Marlon Brando and his T-shirts. There's this fashion is changing, and designers have to keep up with that.
Well, n definitely there was, different things happening. Certainly more of a street look, because that's what the plot demanded. That's one thing. But there's also a loss of income by the late 50s because of the two things. One, television is getting a presence in the home, so more people are staying at home watching television. And the other is there was a lawsuit against the studios, antitrust lawsuit, because the studios also own the theaters, movie theaters. So it was an antitrust lawsuit that studios lost. So they had to sell off many of their theaters, movie theaters. And there was a whole scheme about, the theaters had to play their studio productions, and a little bit complicated. But so they lost revenues from both of those things happening in the 50s. So less revenue, less ability to have the studio system working. And certainly by the 1960s, a lot of societal things going on. So the wardrobe departments, among many other things, are shrinking. Long-term contracts are out the door. Designers are being hired, one movie at a time. Instead of having the whole design each costume and have it made at the studio, they're selecting clothes off the rack, some department store or some clothing store, instead of making them. So by the and the studios are making fewer movies and doing more television shows. So what's keeping some of the wardrobe departments alive is they're making and dressing some of the TV show personnel. So by 1970, the studio system is dead, and there are no longer any costume designers on staff being hired for a particular job.
And those names have gone. Well, I mean, what do you feel about when you look at costume design today, when you're looking at the the when you're watching the Oscars, for instance, and you're seeing who is being rewarded today, how's your feeling towards the industry and towards the stuff that's being created?
Well, there are excellent designers. There was a great batch just up for the Oscars this time around. There have been for the last several years, but they have to work independently from any organization. They work as contractors. They're given very little budget and very little time to do what they have to do. It's amazing that they're able to do the job that they're given the mandate to do under a lot of pressure. The ones that win are usually the historical period movies or the fantasies. Those are usually the winners rather than the contemporary settings. In a way, that's kind of a shame, but the contemporary settings no longer have things like glamour that really make a splash, or create, contemporary settings. Nobody dresses for anything. So, how do you distinguish that kind of costume design?
How do you want, you don't want Fred Astaire's tux anymore because nobody wears tuxes.
So it has to be a setting that's far away, or in a fantasy setting, actually, or it's historical to really distinguish it from other movies, to really bring out the skill of a designer. And a lot of it really has to be taken off the rack, because they just don't have the time to make things from scratch. They can alter, they can select vintage things, they can alter those, but they're certainly under a lot of time constraints. And they do a good job for what they're having to do.
I was trying to think of the last movie that sort of had an impact on how people dress. And I mean, I remember Annie Hall. Well, I don't remember, but Annie Hall in the late 70s, early 80s. People would wear Diane Keaton's sort of Annie Hall look, but it was kind of more Diane Keaton's what she went to the charity shop and the thrift shop and picked up. It was her taste as much as the film's taste at that point. I can't think of anything more recent, really, that feels like it's had a huge impact.
With young people, Clueless made a splash.
Yeah, that's a very good example. Yeah, there's got to be some high school movies that probably did. Yeah, there's an example where I'm out of touch. Clueless, one of my favorite films of recent years. Well, recent years, my God, I bet that's 20 years old.
Yeah, time
Oh,
flies.
don't tell me about it, brother. And what's your you said at the very beginning of our conversation that your great aunt was in the industry. Have you got any are you tied to the industry yourself, via family or personally?
No, not really. Locally, I'm on the board of directors of the Coronado Island Film Festival, so I do film festival stuff, but I don't have any ties to the movie business at
Oh,
all.
Coronado Island, though, it's some like it hot. That's the there's our that hotel where Tony Curtis, nobody speaks like that with Marilyn Monroe.
Actually, because of two things, the Hotel del Coronado and the Naval Air Base here in Coronado, both of those drew a lot of movie making to Coronado. Rudolph Valentino came to make a movie here back in the early 1919, late 19-teens, and many others came to make movies with the Hotel Del as a setting. And then the first book about naval aviation took place at North Island here. Was a silent movie that was shot at North Island, and a lot of World War II movies were shot at North Island, and Top Gun, both versions had scenes there. So Coronado has a pretty long history with filmmaking.
I've swam in the beach and I've been to the hotel briefly to use their bathroom. No, it's a lovely place. I love that. And I've driven past the Air Force base. I think actually I remember stopping somewhere. We were on our way up the main motorway that runs up to Los Angeles, and no, it was past Los Angeles towards San Francisco, and we stopped at we went off the interstate, and we stopped at a diner, and it was just breeze blocks and military personnel, and it was best food I had, actually. It was really delicious, but it's just this very ordinary diner in the off the road. Listen, Christian, one final question before I let you go, and that is there a film book you could recommend for our listeners? I always ask for a recommendation.
Yes, of course, there's so many great ones, but I think if I had to pick one book to read, it's David Thompson's The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood. And of course, he's an excellent writer. This one was published in, I think, 2004. So it covers the earlier Hollywood history. Nowadays, it's just as far as what's going on is kind of a total mess. But if you want to understand, read one book to understand how the whole, he calls it the whole equation, how all aspects of Hollywood movie making worked. That's the book to read. He takes either movie stars or directors or movie moguls and looks at distribution, exhibition, the finance, so that you can understand all aspects of how everything's interconnected and how it all worked to how the whole system worked in the movie making industry. So it's really a unique way that he approached that book, so you can understand really all the inner workings of Hollywood, and it's quite unique, I thought, in that sense.
I've read a lot of David Thompson books. I haven't read that one, so that's one I'm going to put right on my list. The Great Equation.
The
The
whole
whole
equation.
equation, the whole equation. There you go. Definitely have to write it down now. Thank you so much, Christian. It's been wonderful talking to you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.